Good morning, everyone. So we are going to talk about pastors, and I was thinking about pastors and how they change. You know, a lot of things maybe prepare you for working as in pasture as a researcher. And one of those things I was reflecting on just a moment ago would be my teenagers. I've got three teenagers right now, and they're very dynamic. They change a lot. Those moods change a lot. And often in pastures, we have the same thing happening with forage. Okay, if you just take a think about a forage plant from the time it's a seed till it germinates into it's germinating and develops into a mature and productive plant, all of the cycles that it goes through with regard to environmental changes and changes we imply or give it through management or fertilization or grazing or those kinds of things mean that a lot of the measurements that we take in pastures are really just little snapshots in time. Okay, we take a little snapshot when you're born, and we take a little snapshot at your fifth birthday party, and we take a little snapshot when you graduate from high school, and we do the same thing in pasture experiments a lot of times, expecting that that one snapshot is going to describe the entire life of that pasture, its productivity. And that's a difficult way for us to really understand about what's really happening in the dynamics of pastures. And our goal needs to be to take enough snapshots that maybe we don't have a video of the entire life, but at least we can develop over time a nice looking mosaic of what that pasture really is, okay, and what it really means in terms of outputs that we're interested in. Now, I guess that gets us down to the fundamental question of what makes a pasture good. And I've thought about this a lot. What makes a pasture good? And I've decided that what makes a pasture good is really defined by the objectives that you have for that pasture. Okay? What is a fantastic pasture for one producer in one environment and working with a certain set of livestock may be a complete failure in a different time, in a different environment, or with different management. And so it is an objective drawn and an objective defined set of circumstances. Now, to get to the specifics about what we need to measure in pastures to develop that mosaic that really tells us about their life, we often sort of start and stop by measuring forage mass. Okay? And forage mass, just to give it a quick definition, is really just how much pasture, how much forage is there right now? It is a classic snapshot in time. Now, the physical measurements of forage mass are known to most of us. Lots of times we'll cut various sizes of quadrats, so we'll maybe harvest either small or larger portions of that pasture with mechanical equipment. And I think what we find from a lot of that work, and I've looked at a lot of the literature in this area over the past few years, is that we don't measure quite enough most of the time because it gets to be expensive and, frankly, a pain in the rear. Okay? Sometimes our budgets won't let us measure enough. And, in fact, I made just a quick graph of some cool season grass pastures prior to grazing, when most of these samples were collected from several different studies in the chart on the... All right, I'm going to admit, I have trouble with right and left. All right? I cannot do right and left most times. If I say something's on the right and it's not there, look on your other right, and it'll be over there. Okay? Work on that. But on this chart is the standard error of measurement in a pasture in kilos per hectare, and then the number of samples that have to be collected, again, based on 9 different studies where most of these were collected from quadrats or quadrat-sized experiments. And you can see that in these studies that if you wanted to get under 200 kilos per hectare, which is a reasonable goal, I think, in many cases, that means every time you sample, each unit probably requires 8 or 9 different areas to be sampled. And I've read way too many papers where people say we went out and cut 1 or 2 quadrats and we decided that's what the pasture had. It's typically not enough. And if you get into pastures that have more variation, and these had probably as little as you're going to come by, it'll take more. Okay? The Indirect measures of forage mass have been around a long time for the right reasons. Okay? It's a pain to collect all those quadrats or all those strips or all those however you collect the grass. And there's been several really good papers looking at different types of indirect measurements of forage mass, whether it's rising plate meters, falling plate meters, some really nice work from Iowa State from Keith Harmony's graduate work looking at several of those, particularly with the Robel pole, which is used more by our friends in wildlife and conservation. These can certainly help us collect better, or at least more measurements of forage mass, if we do a good job of calibrating them. Okay? The R-squares that you find for indirect measures do vary a lot, range from about, 0.3 to as much as over, as much as 0.8 or even sometimes higher, depending on the care taken with calibration as well as just the limitations of the technology itself. One of the things that you saw yesterday in the graduate student competition with some of the work that particularly Josh Pittman's done down at the Noble Foundation looking at using some of the sensors that you can use to measure forage mass. We've also done some work at Missouri, and here's just some equipment that we put together also that uses actually ultrasound to measure pasture, which mounted on the front of a four-wheeler. You can go driving around the pasture and get lots and lots of measurements of forage height, like 20 to 50 per second. And in about 10 minutes, you have more data than you can analyze in a week, all right? But these are some of the technological pieces that I think in the future we're going to have to look to be able to measure forage mass in a way that allows us to do it not only on the average for a pasture, but also puts that together with GPS units to really measure and to map the spatial variability of what happens in pastures. If I got my way on grazing experiments, and you said, what is the minimum, because that's what everybody always asks you, what's the minimum I can do and really describe that pasture well, I guess I would make this chart for each of your treatments. Okay? And I would map forage mass at some period of time that allows me to get reasonable ideas of the changes that are happening, particularly during the grazing periods, and I also would try to get forage accumulation. Okay, so in this chart, whichever side of that graph that is, could be right or left, I'm not sure anymore, but on that side, that vertical axis over there would be kilos per hectare. These are different months of the year and a couple of different grazing periods here, kind of in these darker grayed areas. Forage mass, as you can see in this particular bit of work, remained in a reasonably constant level during the season, so with some longer rest periods here. But forage accumulation is mapped here, and there's some really nice work by Dave Barker published in the Agronomy Journal here just a couple of years ago looking at some of the Gompertz equations. And when you get your head wrapped around that math, and it did take me a couple of days to wrap my head around the Gompertz math a little bit, can be very powerful in telling you what treatments can do. Another thing that's a challenge, I think, for forage mass, and particularly as we try to measure forage accumulation, is understanding what happens during the grazing period. And we've often, during the grazing period, to make some estimation of forage growth during those grazing periods, used exclosures. And I think John Goretzky this morning was talking about, on some on-farm research, how the exclosures were sometimes difficult to keep track of, or they get moved around. They're also a pain to deal with in terms of they're heavy often, or they're difficult to get from one place to the next place. Measuring inside of them can be hard. And in fact, I argue that some of them are so small that you get a lot of micro climate effects in them sometimes. And because of all of those issues, what do? We pick the minimum number we think we can actually get by with instead of looking at it from a perspective of how little variation can we come by. For 100 years, I'll argue, we've known if you have a certain variation in samples and you want to estimate a sample within a certain level of precision how many you have to collect. And yet too few of us, but prior to the experiment, take the time to go through those calculations and then design how we're going to sample based on that. Okay? And it's a worthy exercise. It's, if nothing else, it's an eye-opening exercise as to what you can and cannot do. The reason we're interested in forage mass is because it helps us understand some things about either herbage allowance or its inverse grazing pressure, and for a number of studies will show us how that grazing pressure influences animal intake. Here's some work, fairly recent work, looking at two different grazing pressures. And remember, grazing pressure is animal mass divided by herbage mass. It is another point in time or a snapshot of what's happening. But in this experiment, the grazing pressure was either at 40 kilos per kilo or at 27. And they had two initial forage masses, either 1,600 kilos per hectare or 2,400 kilos per hectare. Okay? They were looking at intake, and interestingly in this work, grazing pressure was a far larger determinant of animal intake than was forage mass. Okay? So we often measure forage mass, say, oh, that's what it is. But really, it's grazing pressure that often drives intake, and we're often interested in intake of animals. Okay? So keep that up in mind. Also, some work, I won't go into it deeply here, and I'm sure some of my colleagues following me will explain in greater detail, but that grazing pressure also affects pasture utilization as well as disappearance of forage from the pasture, as you might expect. Beyond forage mass in grazing experiments and forage accumulation, and I hope we see more papers with forage accumulation, okay? But beyond that, the literature has some examples of other measurements in grazing experiments, but not much. There are papers we can find things about photosynthesis a few times, growing points or tillering, and we know that's very important in terms of the long-term productivity and understanding the physiology of the pasture is sometimes measured. Very little, frankly, grazing research looks at the stored energy dynamics of plants or even reproductive versus vegetative growth. We often describe it, it was grass when we turned in and it had some seed heads when we left, okay? But in terms of looking at things in a numerical way of describing reproductive and vegetative growth or reproductive development, we don't often see that in the literature, and yet there's some very good scales that can help us describe those things and I think lead us to some better conclusions about what's happening to the plants in the pasture during grazing. And it would be great if we could all put our collective brains together and figure out how these things then relate to livestock outputs, maybe traditionally, or beyond that, how they lead to ecosystem services or what their influences are for things beyond just more beef or just more milk. And I think one of the limitations that I personally have is that I want to say, as a plant scientist, I know what all the plant parts are and what they do, but I'm not sure I always do, okay? And I need to give myself a little primer once in a while about what are the important reproductive structures and how do these things physiologically connect to what happens in a grazing experiment. And so I challenge myself in this case to do a better job of thinking about how plant morphology and how plant development influences the grazing experiment and those things. Determining species composition is another area in which we have some research but probably could do an even stronger job than we do in grazing experiments, whether those things are like dry weight rank methods or various point count systems are used. Also some very good work looking at NIR or other instruments to be able to do those things post time in describing species composition of pastures. Better yet would be to see if we can't use some of those measurements to figure out things about animal herbivory. Of all the time I wish I had back in this world, it would probably be from esophageally fistulated animals. Because you can certainly get data from them. What the data means, I'm yet to figure out exactly. We often have very few of these animals available to us. They're expensive, okay? And while they certainly tell us what that animal ate on that morning when I was out there watching them for that hour, what that really means in the context of a longer season, what that means in terms of the entire grazing system or grazing period, I think can be pretty dubious, okay? And it is beyond the scope of most of our research budgets to have lots of these animals scattered all over the experiment the entire year. And so how do we figure out how to use this sort of information in a way that really means something? And this is an area where I think technology in the future will help us to solve some of these problems. Okay, and in fact, here are some guys putting some GPS collars on livestock. Watch him put it on there for a second. And that's about a $50 logger. That'll log where that animal is every second for a long time. I'll guarantee it'll log more data than you want to analyze. How about that? A lot of data, and you put it on a lot of animals. But we can use this sort of information, I think, in the future to figure out not only where animals are, but if we're smart about what animals are eating and how they're behaving in ways in pastures that we've not yet begun to understand. Now, here's the classic problem in trying to measure the dynamic pasture. Labor, in my view, represents about 80% of the experimental cost. And while I think I'm building the pyramids and I've got that sort of labor force behind me, the fact is, the guy there in the bottom, and he's a great guy, let me show that picture of him, but we've only got so much help to do some of these things, all right? Training of field workers takes time, and a lot of the things we want to measure are not exactly exciting bits to go measure, okay? And so turnover, if we're not careful, can be an issue. So, in describing the dynamic pasture, I think the future looks maybe something like this. I think in the future we're going to be able to outline grazing units probably off of something like Google Maps or the likes. And I think we're going to figure out some way to electronically estimate forage mass. And I'll add to that, and I should have added this earlier, we're also going to be able to electronically measure where animals are the entire time. We're going to see probably increasing use of this kind of thing, where there's going to be something flying over and measuring where those plants are, what they look like, and where the animals are in relation to what's happening in our grazing experiment. And there are a lot of technology bits that can help us in this area. And not only will we see those things happen for measuring plants, but we'll also use them, particularly with RFID tags and animal ears probably, to measure things about the behavior of the animals, either whether they're heads up or whether they're heads down. All those things are possibilities. Okay, and there are a lot of peaceful uses for drones, as you can see there as well, some of which I'm not really excited about. Okay, the challenge will be we are used to working with data sets this big. And I've been collecting some data for a few years where we're collecting data every 20 times a second on something. Excel quits at a million lines, I find, all right? It does. And when you get into some of these larger things, you start to work with someone who has to put it onto a SQL server for you or something, that's beyond the scope of my ability. it sometimes gets beyond the scope of the ability of some of the people you're working with, even in the information technology area. And so you have to sort of forge your own path. And sometimes forging that path is, it sounds like you're being innovative, but what it is a whole lot of work. Okay. Anyway, we're likely to get data that looks something like this, whether those are, it could be any number of things. Those could be where a drone's flown over and given you ideas about what plants are available in what areas, or the forage mass, or in any number of measurements that could be used, including livestock measures. We'll have to process that data. And then we're going to have to turn it into some sort of decision-making process that can be used to say, yeah, this was the right management, or no, that one didn't work. Okay, you got to turn a million points into something that even Rob Kallenbach can understand, and that's the challenge. Okay, so the grazing research teams of the future, and I'll say those who can measure the dynamic pasture, are going to look different. I've been very interested in crowdsource funding. You ever hear? You follow that in the newspaper? Crowdsource funding. I've been reading some books about these kinds of things. Anybody in here read the book The Wisdom of Crowds by Sawecki? Oh, we'll talk about it here in a moment. But let me just say that I think crowds, when we think of crowds as researchers, let's say it that way, we have some very different kinds of thoughts about crowds than others may think of them. Like, here is how I see crowds, sort of the angry mob, right? They're all trying to get into my research. There's some animal scientists beating on me over here, and an economist over here, and some social scientist saying I'm not doing it right. Okay? This is how we view them sometimes. Or like the last time I went to the dean's office. You know, this is the kind of crowd you may be expecting. All right? You may be even expecting a crowd here that looks like when I was at the football game not long ago. Now, despite the SAT scores of these very bright students here, wow, is that a crowd to be involved in? Now, you try to find the wisdom in there, takes some time. Okay, it takes some time. Or you might think the wisdom of crowds here is something like the Rotary Club. You know, a lot of very accomplished people in business who don't have a real strong inkling or strong background in agriculture have a lot to offer us if we think about what it is that we're trying to measure in pastures. And so I will say this. Here's what we do know about crowds. Crowds can be a lot smarter than we might think. Okay? They can even be smarter than my friend Monty Roquette. All right? They can solve problems. And if the successful programs tomorrow depend on effective collaboration. Okay? In fact, Sawecki in his book, The Wisdom of Crowds, he asks the question, are crowds consistently smarter than a single smart person? And he uses research from all different areas, including voting patterns and stock markets, even scientific research, to ask the question, can a crowd be smart? And if you read the book, you'll say, yes, if a crowd follows three rules. And the reason I bring this up, as we develop grazing research teams, we're going to need to ask these kinds of questions. His first thing is the crowd diverse? And it's not diversity of skin color or ethnicity that's important. It's diversity of ideas. And the reason that's important is that it brings more solutions, more potential solutions to the same problem. Okay? Can the group members make independent judgments? It's important that one old professor or bully person in the room doesn't dominate the conversation, but rather people can all sort of make judgments about, is this a good idea, is this a good solution, or is it not? And then you have to have some method for aggregating those decisions. Okay? Stock markets do this very well. Scientific research teams, maybe not as well. We need to think about how we build the team to measure this dynamic thing as a pasture. And so I'll conclude by saying these things from a mechanistic point of view. Minimum measurements, I would argue, are measuring pasture mass and measuring it frequently enough that you can detect changes in the pasture that are greater than 10%. The reason I use 10%, if you look at some of the work that Matt Sanderson's done, he would say that it's probably won't say impossible, but very difficult for us to estimate a lot closer than that with any level of frequency. Now, one of the mistakes I do see in pasture research is people often measure at one time every week or once every 2 weeks or once per month. I would argue that it really needs to be dynamic based on what the pasture is doing. Is it growing? Maybe you should measure more often. Is it dormant? Maybe not so much. Okay. Forage accumulation, I would argue, needs to be in more of the literature for us to really be able to compare treatments well on a season-long basis. Be great to have some measurements of morphological stage, at least at the initiation of grazing. More often than that would be fantastic. Plant and tiller density, at least at the start and end of experiments, and more often, all the better. There will be a lot of technological advances in the next 10 years and in the next 20 years about how we're going to measure pastures. Our challenge will be dealing with this large amounts of data and hooking up with the right people who can help us get from engineering to data. Okay? And that collaboration, if you don't like collaborating with people, I would argue in grazing research, you just need to quit now. Okay? Because it'll be difficult. I won't say you can't, but it'll be difficult to survive without the collaboration of a lot of others. Thank you. Okay. Wayne says time for one question. Oh, wow. Oh, sorry. Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I can't hear what you said. How do I propose that we integrate the wisdom of crowds? Here's what I say. Before you start the grazing experiment, you need to put together, if you can, a team of people that is diverse, that can bring a lot of perspectives to what you want to do. So you're a plant scientist. Bringing an animal scientist in is certainly a good idea. We've done a lot of that over the years. But what about bringing in someone who looks at it from the social science perspective? What if you bring in a psychologist or a sociologist that says, look, you can do this research, but it'll be difficult for you to apply it on farm or get people to do this because there's some social reason they won't do it? Or how do we overcome some of those barriers and address those questions in the research? Okay? Maybe you bring in somebody from an engineering perspective, again, who can think of ways to measure stuff that you would not have thought of had you not had them on the team. Maybe you bring in people from outside. Maybe you get somebody from the Rotary Club to come take a look at your research and say, who has no clue about grazing research. All they know about is how to eat steaks, but they're interested in it. Okay? Those are some different ideas there.
All right, let's thank our speaker again.